Accession number 19990, Reel 21.
Chief Technician Roper, Reel 21. You were saying that whilst your young married man did the early failure detection tests with the magnetic plugs, you ran the bay.
I ran the bay, and more or less on my own at the start. I then had a young sergeant who came in to work with me, but he, I don't think had done much on the Nome previously, but he was a good man, and we coped quite nicely, but the work was constant, and you felt you couldn't afford to take leave, because, well, either somebody would have to come in that didn't know what was what and might cause more problems than he was worth, to put it blindly. But the thing is that the squadron was operating quite nicely. We didn't send any engines back. And it came a time when the hierarchy from the UK were coming out to see what had been set up. And they came to see me, and they said, "Have you got any problems?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "We've got problems with balancing the damaged engine compressors." I said, "It would be nice if I could take out a compressor that's damaged, put it in a box, send it back to England, get it repaired down at the naval repair place in Hampshire, and they could send that same component back to me a fortnight later, and I could put it back into my engine, and the hours are all the same, there's no problem, it's been repaired, it's been tested, I put it back in, and that would be easier than having to send the whole engine back." So they talked about this, and the engineering officer out there said, "Well, it would be better if we got HAECO, who are the Cathay Pacific engineers for the civvies, if we could supply them with the..." Where had we got to?
You're talking about the engineer officer saying that if HAECO...
Oh yes, if we could get a Schenck balancing machine and give it to HAECO, they could do this job on the spot. So I wasn't overly keen on this, but the engineering officers agreed, and so...
Why weren't you keen on it?
Well, HAECO, they were used to dealing with huge engines from 707s and the like, but this is rather like a Singer sewing machine by comparison. And I could foresee that the problem would be getting the blades to if you've got a huge bank of these blades, and remember there are 10 different sizes, and they have all got to be balanced with counterweights and the like, to any unit that wasn't used to doing this, and for the first time, I would never see it reach fruition, and I thought it was a bit of a waste of time, unless they had such a bank of these spare blades. So I thought, no, it'll never work. But anyway, my sort of thoughts didn't count. So at the same time, Hong Kong Airport, Kai Tak, was very limited because of its length of runway and its equipment for dealing with an aircraft accident. So the Air Force, in its wisdom, said, "Well, our VC-10s are operating here, so what we need is the facility to remove a VC-10 that has crashed on the runway." So out came one of the largest aircraft, it's like a huge bomb trolley that you could put a fuselage on to get it off the runway with. It's special equipment for removing crashed aircraft. They have them at London Airport and the major airports. This thing came over, and through having this piece of equipment, it helped to operate the category of airfield that Kai Tak was, so it meant they could do night landings or whatever. This all seemed a bit strange to me, but more to the point was I could see the end of my tour coming up, and so I said to the engineering officer that came out from the UK, look, I've spent 2 years getting this bay running. Unless somebody takes over from me that has the same experience, it's just going to go to nothing. Because what was happening, a man of the same rank as myself had fallen foul of the hierarchy on the squadron, and so they posted him to me. Now, apart from the fact that he, I mean, I got on all right with him, we were both chief techs together, this wasn't the man that would have the experience to replace me in 6 months' time. And I could foresee that because they would no longer be there either, they couldn't care less. So I said to the visiting officer, I said, well, we must have somebody posted out that has got the experience. And he said, right. So they posted out the experienced man, a sergeant who'd worked with me previously at Odeon, and instantly he is taken and put into the hangar, where he's not happy, I'm certainly not happy. And so I sort of said, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you can shut the bay and send all your engines back to UK if this is the way you're going to behave. Plus, I found out why we'd got the Schenck balancer to Hako and why we had got a VCT and crashed trolley. Because the senior engineering officer immediately resigned his commission and went to be a manager for Hako. And this is the sort of problems that really the Air Force doesn't sort of seem to cope with very well, you know. That
conflict of interest.
Well, people are feathering their own nest and so on. And if you've got somebody who, like myself, is trying to maintain a standard and so on, when this sort of thing happens, what, you know, what's it all about, really? And it really upset me. So I left Hong Kong. Admittedly, I got my way, but I made myself very unpopular through doing it, and it didn't do my career any good in the long run. But
who was actually responsible for these postings and so on? Then who?
Well,
was it the local administration?
No, normally, you see, my posting was for one deep servicing qualified senior NCO, probably.
Yes.
It might not have been a chief tech. It was a chief tech going to fill it, but a sergeant could have filled the post.
Yeah.
So long as he had this experience. But, of course, because it was a one-off post, there was only one of us, when they're sending the replacement, and of course, my overall in charge, I have above me a flight sergeant, or a warrant officer, and a flight lieutenant. Now, because the flight lieutenant doesn't like the face of one of the people he's got, he takes the new man that's been sent to replace me and puts his man that's fallen foul into the position of the person he's taken, which he can't fill. And of course, when you point this out, that it's got to be a deep servicing qualified personnel or whatever, he must have had such and such a course. Oh, that's all right. He'll learn on the job or something. And it's that's the sort of thing that really sort of
it's the politics of personality.
It is.
Then.
It is. And as I say, I made sure I got my way, but it might have done the bay at Kai Tak some good, but it certainly didn't do me any good in the long run.
What was it like living in Hong Kong? Was this your first time in Hong
Kong,
wasn't
it?
Not pleasant. What's wrong with it?
Well, Hong Kong is like a beehive all the time anyway. It really buzzes. Millions of people all living in fairly confined areas. And when I first got out there, Because I'd done unaccompanied tours and a fair length of service, I had a fair amount of merit quarter points, if you like.
Yes.
And so I moved into a flat at a place called Mayfus St. Jean, which was a new estate. It was high-rise blocks. I think they were 18 stories high. And there were dozens of them in a very few acres of land. But they were beautifully... in between these blocks were podiums, sort of terraces, built up to two stories, which housed shopping centres and gardens and things. And it won awards. I think it's the greatest concentration of people living on, say, 5 acres of land. But also, you didn't feel as though you were sort of...
Crowded in.
Mm. But you got home every night and you took the lift up to floor 18. And in hurricanes, you probably couldn't get your flat door open because the building sways by about 6 feet. And these flats were costing the Air Force... as much as it would have cost to have put me into a flat in Mayfair. The cost was horrendous in Hong Kong. But then the RAF owned certain blocks of flats nearer Kai Tak. There was one at Sunderland Road, and there was the flats at Edat Do. And what happened was you started life at Mayfus St. Jean, which was a bit out of the way, and you had to be bussed into work every day. It wasn't as convenient for any of the families to go to any of the swimming pools or to get into the town. Everything was a bit difficult, although the flats were very nice. And so you were initially housed there. And then you were put on the waiting list to move into the quarters nearer the camp. And eventually I was moved to Edat Do, which is near where Bruce Lee lived. And it's not too far from the camp. Once again, a flat. With young children, there was nowhere for them to play other than on concrete. The hills out there had concrete flashings because they'd wash away, so they were like little pyramids, if you like, and the kids used to slide down this. You could get rid of a pair of trousers a day if you were a child of four, no trouble at all, you know. But clothing and things were very cheap. You could buy him a pair of shoes every week, and it wasn't sort of any hardship. But the weather was abysmal compared to Singapore. It could be hot, it could be sticky, it could be cold, it could be miserable rain, and the cyclones and the like, and typhoons were quite frequent, about 5 or 6 affecting the colony every year. Compared to Singapore, it was less of the Orient. In Singapore, you get the feeling that you're in Chinatown, rickshaws and that sort of thing. There were still rickshaws and trishaws and things in Hong Kong, but it's so westernised, it's unbelievable. All the tailor shops, everything's made to measure, whereas in Singapore, you picked the cloth, he made your shirts, he made your shorts, everything was made and made to measure, beautiful. Hong Kong, it's off the peg, and it's all Americanized, sort of shiny suits and so on. Not quite the same. And as I say, for me, Hong Kong was, they said, you get twice as much for your Singapore dollar in Hong Kong as you would in Singapore, but I never found that to be the case. We were well paid, and you could afford to go out. But you had to take your leave out of the colony because nobody was allowed to stay there for 2 straight years. It just wasn't sort of good enough. You had to either go back to England or for a mid-break or to Thailand or to Australia or wherever.
Where did you go for yours?
I went to Thailand, because my wife, her father and mother were in Thailand working for the Thai Glass Company. They're British, but they worked out there and were there for 11 years. And whenever I went on detachment during my Singapore days, when I went to Penang or to Butterworth or to Borneo, I used to get my wife flown up to Thailand to stay with her parents. But I'd never been until I came to Hong Kong and we got this...
opportunity.
Look free leave, they call it. And we decided we'd go and stay in Thailand, and I stayed there for my mid-tour leave, and then I went back and stayed there for terminal leave that I had left before we came home.
What did you do when you got back from Hong Kong?
Well, prior to going to Hong Kong, I was approaching 40, and the overseas tours, accompanied overseas tours, were getting very few and far between. So I knew that when I returned from Hong Kong that I would try and get a posting to a station which was in the area where I could afford to buy a house and would probably settle after leaving the service. My aunt, an elderly aunt, had a very nice house in Harrogate. And with this in mind, as the tour came to an end, you were asked to put in three choices of posting because they were trying to please people. The Air Force was rapidly shrinking. It had changed. The Empire was going. Aden had gone. Cyprus was more or less gone. And Singapore and so on. So people were going out. We'd lost most of the veterans from the war. You found that the officers were becoming much younger. And, of course, in 1971, when Rolls-Royce collapsed and they cancelled the TSR2 project, there were a lot of engineers from civilian life that came into the Air Force as instant squadron leaders and junior officers.
This on the technical side?
On the technical side. Now, this was rather upsetting for us because having worked for warrant officers for most of our service career, you only got as far as the warrant officer who made the decisions. The engineering officer you saw very seldom, and you only saw him if there was any real problem that warranted his intervention. But all of a sudden, the warrant officers seemed to disappear. Most of them, I think, left the service. And instead of a warrant officer, you had a flying officer who had a good engineering background, but no service background. And you got to the days where you could slap your CO on the back and call him Peter or something, which didn't gel with the older members, as I was. We preferred it to be sort of yes sir, no sir.
You would like a more structured approach to...
That's right. I mean, we knew our place. And, of course, they always used to say in my day that the station is run from the sergeant's mess. Because if you had supply problems, you went to your friend, the flight sergeant, from stores and said, look, I've got this problem, leave it with me, and he would fix it. But once you got these young engineering officers who wanted to do the fixing, it wasn't as easy as it had been. And as I say, the instant squadron leaders, who were good engineers, there was no their background, they'd been Rolls-Royce apprentices and things, but it just wasn't the way the Air Force had been run. And of course, losing all the most experienced warrant officers and pilots who were coming up to retirement age. This suited the Air Force because, of course, it was a shrinking Air Force. And because the postings were less frequent, where you in the past you'd been 2 years on a station and then moved on, now you could be 10 years on a station. And so airmen were being encouraged to buy their own houses. And of course, coming back from Hong Kong as I was, I decided that I would like to buy either the house of my aunt, but I couldn't afford to go back to where I'd been in the Odeum area because houses were far too expensive. So, with Harrogate in mind, I put in for a posting to Leeming, Linton-on-Ouse, but I had to have a third choice of a helicopter unit because of my past experience, because they wouldn't, or they may not want to lose the experience I had. So as a third choice, I put down Leconfield, and as a negative choice, I put down not Odeum, because I'd been posted back from overseas three times to Odeum, and the work there, if you got the right job, you were all right, but if you got the wrong job, you were on Salisbury Plain most of the time. So I said, right.
Did you think you were getting a bit old for Salisbury Plain?
Well, no. I mean, I like the sort of exercise bit of it, but you can get too much of living in a tent. And, of course, the Air Force had learned a very serious lesson. In fact, I think all services, with that years unaccompanied in Borneo, they had so many broken marriages, broken homes, all sorts of problems, not only with the airmen, but with the officers as well. Wives had left them. Sometimes they were involved with friends of the person who was overseas. And it was a really messy business. And the Air Force suddenly realised that this was a bad thing. And they tended then to, in the case of Borneo, there were a lot of married people from Singapore that were posted for a sort of 3 months detachment, and then they went back to Singapore to join the families. But to split the family up of young, particularly young married people, and take the husband away for a year was certainly a bad thing, and it was a lesson they learnt through that. And of course, there were more of these unaccompanied postings, Belize and Northern Ireland and so on. And so I presume they did a rethink, and they tried to make the detachment as short as possible. As I say, a lot of the airmen were encouraged to buy their own houses. And with this in mind, Leeming, Linton-on-Ouse or Leconfield as a third choice. Of course, I got the third choice because of a past experience. But what I didn't realise was that Leconfield was the northern SAR headquarters. You had in the south, you had Manston and places like this that were helicopter flights, and they were, I think it was Tangmere was their base, but Leconfield served Valley in North Wales, Accrington, Leconfield itself, the flight at Leconfield, Lossiemouth and Lucas.
What's an SAR?
Search and rescue helicopters. These are the yellow helicopters, yes, that we see around the coast. So I was coming from the Odeum environment, which was internal security and 38 group helicopters, Army
Corporation,
into a different world altogether, but the same machines, which was the search and rescue. And so I was to be posted to Leconfield. Well, unbeknown to me, of course, Leconfield then decided who would go and run the flights at Accrington and Lucas and Lossiemouth. And so before I actually arrived at Leconfield, I was posted to Accrington, up to Accrington.
Where is Accrington?
It's on the Northumberland coast. It's now an open cast, well, it was an open cast mine, and it's a prison now.
Way,
but it's
a long way from Leconfield.
Oh, yes. It's an old RAF base, and the thing is that the nearest town is Alnwick, which is a very nice part of the world, but it's sort of a bit rugged on that coast. And, of course, it wouldn't have been good for getting employment after leaving the service, although I'd always intended to carry on with my hobby, which was book collecting and book selling. This had come about because during the 1970 period, the pay in the forces, particularly in the Air Force, was very poor. And pilots used to say, and these were fairly senior pilots, flight lieutenants and squadron leaders, happiness is getting the same pay as a London bus driver. And they actually were on comparable pay rates. And so a lot of people were sort of, they called it moonlighting. And many of them had sort of other occupations to try and boost their salaries a little bit. And mine, I used to deal in books through the post to try and supplement the pay that wasn't particularly good. Later.
What at first attracted you to doing that? Do you remember what it was that drew your attention?
Well, I'd always collected books, whether it was books on aeroplanes and aero engines and things, but having done a tour in Borneo, there wasn't a lot to do in Borneo. You just wandered round and looked at the what there was to see and the museum and so on. But the White Rajas had controlled Sarawak, and this sounded very romantic. And of course, I fell in love with the place. The people were, the native people were so friendly. That I thought, and these Dyak headhunters and so on, that when I came back to the UK in 1965, not many people were interested in Borneo, and I used to like going round the bookshops, and I started collecting books on Borneo, and as you get a few, you read up on the bibliographies at the back of the books, of other books, and it became an obsession. And over the last 35 years, I've collected practically everything in English written on Borneo up to the 1960s. But in order to pay for the hobby, because some of the rarer books, it was a good subject to choose from the point of view that the history of Borneo, the modern history, only started in 1840 when the White Raja went there.
This would be James Brooke.
James Brooke, yes. And so books published between 1840 odd and to date wouldn't be tremendously expensive. I mean, some of them are today, but in those days, £20 would have been a very expensive book. And I started collecting, and because I couldn't really afford all the books I would have liked, and visiting the bookshops, I found books that I knew other people would like. I started to deal in books in order to pay for my own hobby. But as you buy books that you can't sell at the time, stocks build up until the house was more like a bookshop than
you need a storage place.
So on leaving the service, I decided that a shop was the answer and moved the books into a shop, and this I did. But I find myself now that having been posted to Leconfield, I'm up on the Northumbrian coast in a rather bleak and windy sort of spot, and no chance of my wanting to buy a house up there. Having been shipped back from Hong Kong, I had quite a lot of leave, and as I hadn't got a quarter arranged at Accrington because there was no vacant quarters, I had to put my family into a holding unit, which was one of my old stations, RAF Dishforth, which was now a police training school, but still had a lot of RAF quarters there that were used for transients and for people. When people went away on these postings abroad without their wives, on occasions they were moved into accommodation on these holding units. So I moved my wife and family to Dishforth, spent my leave sort of visiting relatives and looking around the area to see, you know,